This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, how you doing? I'm Craig Parkinson. You are listening to the Two Shot Podcast. Sit yourself down, pop the kettle on. We're going to have a nice old chat. Who's it with this week? I'm going to tell you right now. How the devil are you? Yes, it's Thursday. And look, I know we've had Thursdays in the past. That's not a new thing. But what I'm saying is it's Thursday and this is a new episode of the Two Shot Podcast. What can I say? I'm sorry about the last couple of weeks. I apologise. You've all been very, very patient is what you've been. Patient and kind. And what that's exactly what we need in this day and age. Well, I went on holiday. And then just life got in the way, didn't it? It's difficult and it's time consuming. But I'm here to tell you we are back with a brand new episode this week. And it's with the one and only lead singer of The Darkness, Justin Hawkins. And it's an incredible conversation. What a lovely guy. We'd never met. We didn't know each other. He had been told that this was a good podcast to come on to. So whoever told him that, I'm very grateful. Thank you, mysterious person. And we'd been chatting and set up a time and date. He was in Switzerland. I was in Manchester. So we made it work over the internet. Sadly, not in person. But we are going to get back to those very soon. I know producer Griff cannot wait. And neither can I. But this is a great chat. I think you'll tell by the end of it that we both really enjoyed each other's company. And we talk about all sorts, as you know what we're doing. I must give a little trigger warning, though. We do touch on drug abuse towards the latter part of the conversation. So if you don't want to hear about that, then, you know, you can stop listening now or skip forward if you hear anything, or maybe just if you're feeling a bit delicate, just leave this one. But it'll be a shame because it is a great conversation. He is really open, really warm, very kind. We go all the way back. We talk about stage presence, audience, problems, management, grafting, the explosion of fame, how, you know, nothing's an overnight success, success in America, Metallica, Guns N' Roses, just loads of great stuff. And he is fantastic company. And I think you're going to agree. Let's get into it. This is the Two Shot Podcast with the fantastic Justin Hawkins. Enjoy, and I shall see you at the end.
Yeah.
It does that because it thinks we're broadcasting.
Do you know what? With the last 18 months, I'll take the applause where I can get it, mate.
Yeah, same here. Yeah.
I'm sure you feel the same.
I feel your pain.
Justin, how are you today? Are you in Switzerland?
I'm in Switzerland, yeah. Yesterday I got back 2 days ago from a festival. We headlined a festival on a mountain in Wales.
How was that?
You know when you imagine doing something for the first time in ages and you're really looking forward to it? And then you turn up and it's on a mountain in Wales and you've spent the whole of the heat wave in quarantine because of some ludicrous bureaucracy. And then you get on the mountain and it's like a gale force wind blowing your hair into your mouth and it's raining. It was awesome. Actually, loved it. Loved every second of it. But it was kind of like, oh, fuck, yeah, this is why I hate festivals. Awesome to be back.
Well, speaking of festivals, the last time I saw you, it was at Kendall Call, and it was a couple of years, 2 or 3 years ago, I think.
I reckon it might have been 5 years ago, that.
Really? Yeah, oh, my God. What? From what I remember, it was a Saturday afternoon. It was blazing hot sunshine, and the band came on. And this is from my memory. You either somersaulted onto stage or you cartwheeled onto stage, greeted the audience with some very chosen expletives and got bang into like the first number. And I just remember everybody just stood there going, they got really into it. And I just thought to myself, well, that's how you make an entrance. Right. You're coming on for an hour. You know, it's funny,
when in those situations, it's like when we come out and we get that sort of, what the fuck is that reaction? We forget that it's like we don't do it like other bands, you know. It's because we live in a bubble. We don't bother watching the other bands on the bill. We're too busy, you know, reconnecting because we never hang out when we're not working. So we just, you know, we're very insular when we go to those festival sites. We go and do our thing and everyone just looks at us shocked.
But that's kind of, certainly from an audience point of view, it's always been the way with you and the band. You've always seemed to have dance to the beat of your own drum, so to speak. And everybody's, I remember when you first crashed onto the scene, everybody was like, what the fuck are these guys on?
I know, but when we first started off and like even in the early days when we were sort of like, we had a manager who had been looking after us since like our previous incarnation, and we hadn't done anything for a long time, but we sort of had a real kind of loyalty to her, even though we hadn't really achieved anything. We didn't necessarily want to change it. But there was a manager that was sort of sniffing around us, and he was sort of managing up and coming bands of that time, bands that were doing the things that we wanted to do. Mm. And I remember him sort of saying to my brother, you know, is that what he does? What is this? Is this like a prank or is that what he does? And my brother's like, yeah, he does that in rehearsal. It's normal. And, you know, so that was like even from the first gigs, really, it was like that.
Did you ever worry, though, like at the beginning that people weren't going to take you seriously or thought that it was some sort of pastiche?
I think everybody, I don't know what it's like for you. I mean, it's probably the same thing. It's like what you think you're doing and the place that it comes from, you never see it. You never see people taking it in exactly that way. And I was always like, well, okay, well, if people like it because it's funny, that's okay. You know, if people like it because it rocks, that's okay. But nobody's ever going to sort of appreciate the nuance and the things that you think you're putting into stuff. You know, you very seldom find somebody who actually gets what you're trying to do. So you just have to accept anything you can get, really, don't you?
Yeah, I think so. But sometimes it's the same, like with acting. Mm. And it's very rare that I'll go around and watch the monitor, unless it's for a very specific sort of technical reason. I know some actors that go and watch the takes, and I think sometimes it just revolves around vanity sometimes.
I think that's the only reason why I've ever done that in a video shoot or something is just vanity. And I wonder if it's the same for you. When you're doing something and there's a camera on, you can feel if it's going to be rubbish. And sometimes you know it's going to be rubbish, and you just have to keep going because your schedule means that you have to be there. You're dedicated to the cause, but you just know, and your heart sinks, and you still go. I mean, obviously, I'm not suggesting you've ever done anything rubbish.
No, I certainly have done lots of things that are rubbish, I'm sure. And also, sometimes it's like, well, no one sets out, or very rarely, I think anybody sets out to make something rubbish. Mm. And sometimes you just got to get on with the cards that you've been dealt. But it's that feeling that I get sometimes, and not if I'm working, because it can it can be rectified and I can solve that problem. But if I'm certainly what I've been doing when I've been at home, and if I've been auditioning for certain things, sometimes I kind of, and I don't mean this in an arrogant way at all, because I'm far, don't know anything, I don't know everything, but it's like I can tell if a certain take is the one. You got, no, that's it. I don't need to watch it back because I know that's one, but because the rest of them have been rubbish. All the pieces that I've needed haven't been together, but this time the jigsaw's all come together on this take, and that's the one I'll do, and I'll just leave it at that. Do you, you said that you do watch stuff for vanity, but I think certainly with certain videos and what your band is, it requires a level of vanity because it is about that posturing. It is about, you know, quote unquote, being a rock star.
Definitely. I think I heard a story about a singer. I'm not going to name him.
We can beep it out anyway.
Well, sorry. I'll name him. I'll tell you, his name rhymes or sounds a little bit like...
That's okay. We can piece it together.
Okay. And so I heard that when he does anything like photo shoots, video shoots, he has like a massive mirror so he can watch himself. He doesn't need to look at the, you know, the rushes. He doesn't need to do anything else. He always looks fabulous, always does the same stuff. But I think when you have that, you probably end up just doing the same thing all the time. And some people like the side of your face that you don't like. It's that thing of, you know, people get taken it in a different way, isn't it?
But also, I mean, you can't please everybody.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can't please anybody.
Sometimes you can't even please yourself. I mean,
that is my biggest problem.
Yeah, well, it is, isn't it? I mean, that's one of the reasons why I certainly don't watch my work back unless I have to. Mm. But I would never sit down and watch anything because all I'm seeing are the mistakes. Mm. All I'm seeing is, oh, we could have done that better. Because, you know, you're not that you're trying to achieve perfection, but it would never be, I would never watch something and go, yeah, that was very good and I did very well that.
Yay me.
Yeah, exactly. I think, but then again, I know some people that do that, yay me.
I mean, I don't even listen to albums or, like, if I listen to Permission to Land, for example, there's loads of stuff in there. I was like, fuck, I can't even remember doing that. And, you know, like actual vocal parts that I just had forgotten. I just record it and then move on. And then when we play it live, it sort of evolves a bit. I think if I listened to the record, all the gigs would just sound like a recital. And we'd never sort of develop, and the, you know, every show would be the same. So I'd try not to do that, really.
How's it been preparing for, because the tour's coming up soon and you're getting back to, you know, I mean, not that you're getting back together, but everybody's been apart, but we're all coming back together. So how are you feeling about going back out on the road?
Well, I don't know. If it's just like for a festival or something, we tend to get together. We do like an afternoon of rehearsals and then we go to Pizza Express. And then like all the other bands that are on the thing are probably rehearsing for a couple of weeks beforehand. And we're really chaotic when we play and it's exciting. For a tour, we probably do like a week of rehearsals. Sometimes there's production rehearsals if there's anything fancy happening. But the way it feels is like it's just trepidation. I live in a different country to the rest of them. I live on my own. And I don't live in a place where I can just lock it up and walk away from it. So I'm always worried about the garden, burglars. I'm worried about, you know, things leaking when I'm not here. And it's really like, and as soon as I get to the first show, I'm in tour mode and everything's okay. And I love it. I can sleep, I can relax. It's just a great, there's loads of, what's it called, routine in the day.
Yeah.
I get up at the same time every day, I do the same stuff, do my show. Everything's focused on that show time. Everything else is just, you know, a distraction, which I can push away. And I've got people around me to do stuff for me. It's just ace. I love it. But, you know, the period just before it, I'm just sitting there going, oh, do I have to? I think I get too comfortable. Maybe I'm just comfortable wherever I am, you know, whether it's on tour or whatever.
But it could, I always think it must be quite hard keeping up. And I think this sometimes about actors who predominantly work in theatre and they're doing big, long runs and keeping not only the energy, but I suppose the enthusiasm to go out on stage every night. And, you know, you touched on it before, because do you think the chaotic nature of the band helps to keep that up when you're doing a tour?
Yeah, I mean, there's two reasons for it. It's just like, the first one is, in the past, you know, we've been doing this for a long time now. In the past, when we've rehearsed properly and really put the work in, the first couple of shows, it all goes out the window. You know, none of it matters.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like the last show of the last tour, or it's completely, things go wrong, you know, stuff that's completely out of your control, and any amount of rehearsal isn't going to prepare you for it. So it just seems like, well, the first two shows are the rehearsals. So, you know, and then after that, it's kind of like my thing is reacting to the people in the room. You know, it's totally, there's a lot of interaction that happens. And, you know, when things go wrong, it's kind of like my favorite part, really, because I love the awkward silences and I love playing with that stuff. And
it's but just, that's it, exactly. It's a live show. You can rehearse to a certain extent about what you do, but as you've touched on, there is interaction. It's a two-way transaction. Everybody's there together and you don't know what's going to happen. And I suppose that's the excitement of it.
Yeah,
sure.
The other thing is like when I'm pissing about and I'm trying to do, you know, I'm basically just trying to make my brother laugh most of the time. And if, you know, failing that, anybody in the audience, you know, not everybody finds it funny because it's really juvenile a lot of the time. Some physical comedy, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, but if one person finds it funny, out of all those thousands of people, that's okay.
I don't mind if it's me. I don't mind if I'm the one, you know, that's fine. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think the things that are important to me in a show can't be rehearsed. Mm-hmm. And the chaos is what you're hoping for, really, because that gives you something to bounce off, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. But Justin, we're in Switzerland now. Mm. Let's go right back to growing up. Where were we growing up?
We were growing up in Lowestoft. I was born in Chertsey in Surrey, but most of my formative years are in Lowestoft, which is East Anglia, the most easterly point of mainland Britain, seaside town.
And how was it growing up there?
That's a really broad question. It's so
difficult. Yeah.
well, what I mean, we moved around a lot, really. So we experienced lots of different kinds of growing up. Like when we first moved to East Anglia, I was about 6, and I think we lived in Darsham, which is like a tiny village between Lowestoft and Ipswich. And it was a lot of, you know, a lot of families who whose dads worked at the power station. Mm. Or it was actual farmers, you know, and then there might have been a couple of little towns where people worked and stuff, but it wasn't like growing up in London or a city or anything like that. And I think that was deliberate. Mm. My parents were a bit hippie-ish. They wanted us to have they wanted us to keep away from busy roads until they were confident about our cycling ability. We had that, and then we moved to Lowestoft, which is a bit more of a town. You know, there's a lot of drugs around.
What was the need for the movement
don't really know, to be honest. I think it might have been a bit of entrepreneurialism with because my dad's a builder, so I think he was doing up houses, flipping them, and we happened to be living in them at the time. So it was kind of like that was a way for him to accumulate wealth. I think they probably wanted to introduce us to something which more resembled an urban upbringing, but not quite.
Yeah.
When we got to a certain age.
Was it difficult for you and your brother? I mean, I take it you had to change schools quite a lot.
I changed schools a lot, yeah.
Was that difficult for you both?
I don't know about my brother. I can't speak for him. I think he always used to walk around like he owned whatever school he was in. So it was a bit easier for him to adapt. But I think when I was doing it, I just completely changed my look, personality, everything. It was, every time we moved, it was like a method acting.
You know, yeah, reinvention.
Yeah, I totally decide I'll be someone else. And it extended right up to when I went to college as well. I did the same thing. Cut my hair off. Yeah, I did the same thing up there. And then when it finished, when I started the band, same again. But when I started the band, I sort of reverted to one of my earlier personalities, which is probably from about 18 to 21.
It's quite a defense mechanism to do that, especially as a child, going and, right, I'm going to reinvent myself now, and this is the person. Mm. Were you kind of projecting of, well, this is the person that I want to be?
Yeah, and also I always chose a look that was not the trendy, you know? It was always the, not the goth, but, you know, I just wasn't going to dress like the trendies. I don't know why. I wish I had, actually. It would have been more popular probably and, you know, probably would have, I don't know, would have been easier.
Well, who wants to be popular? Looking back, I mean, looking back on it, of course. I mean, I remember saying to someone the other day, I used to hate my name. There was never any Craigs at my school. There was loads of Dans, mm-hmm. loads of Andys. I wanted to be a Dan. I wanted to be in that
Dans
game.
Always do well at school.
They do.
Carls do well?
Very few Carls in my schools.
How old are you?
45.
We're nearly the same age.
Yeah.
When I was growing up, there was... Because like when we... For the first 6 years of my life, I was the only Justin I was aware of. Mm. And then I joined the football team when I was about 13 or 14, and there were six Justins in it.
Justin's very sporty, I've always found.
Do you think so?
Hmm, yeah.
That's interesting.
When did the singing start? When did the theatrics start, I suppose? Because I've got this theory that a lot of actors want to be rock stars, and a lot of rock stars want to be actors.
Mm.
And I'm only basing this off certain musicians that I know.
And what about yourself? Do you want to be a rock star?
No, but I think I used to. I can't sing for the life of me, but I used to have a fascination, and it was nothing that I would ever act on. It was just it was daydreaming, I suppose, as a child that I just want to get up on that stage. I suppose it stems back from my dad's love of watching Queen at Wembley, and we must have watched it about 20 times, and he just had that huge audience in the palm of his hand.
You know what, that album, because that's what, 1986, I mean, what's that, there was a live album they did, wasn't there, after they did Live Aid, and then they did, and the album had the helicopter with Queen on it. It was the Live Magic tour.
Yeah, and they had all the inflatables of the band that would go out into Wembley, and my dad used to have it on video.
Well, my auntie bought me that album on cassette, and it changed my life in exactly the same way.
Yeah.
It was just like, oh my God, this is what I want to do. My brother wanted to be Roger Taylor. Obviously, I wanted to be Brian May because I was a guitar player. You know, I wanted to play guitar.
Mm.
That's how I started off, actually. It wasn't never with a view to being a singer. But I did have I had a weird moment where I was doing I was opening for a band, like a local covers band that were kind of made up of, it's like a sort of super group of the local bands, you know.
Mm.
And there was a guy who ended, or two guys that ended up in being in A. Remember that band?
No.
So that's for around Lowestoft, they were quite big, you know, it's kind of, They were the guys that were really doing it. And so I used to open for them, but I had a completely unrehearsed, it was just me and a guitar and a drum machine, and I'd just make it up. And I was called Bionic Reg, and it was surrealist, totally ad-libbed. And with me singing,
you would go on and just completely improvise.
Completely, yeah, for like half an hour, three quarters of an hour. And I was 18 when I was doing that. And that was the first bit of singing I ever did, you know.
You didn't even know fear at 18. You would just go, this is a great idea and I'm going to do it.
I didn't even think it was a great idea. It was like my friend and I made this helmet, and it was like a... it was an American football helmet with two speakers attached to the side, and it had something like a joystick on the top. I think it was kind of like... And that just seemed to be my cloak of invisibility, or my cloak of nothing can go wrong ability. It was just like... And then we developed it a bit and sort of added kind of... had things hanging off my guitar and stuff. But it really was just It was just me reacting to the room, you know. It was just... But a girl came up to me afterwards, and that's obviously massive bonus already. Mm-hmm. And she told me that my voice was like, that I should get some classical training because my voice sounds like a grade 8 opera singer. And I was like, yeah, okay, cool. And I just sort of banked that and didn't do anything about it. And I just, because I still wanted to be a guitar player. And,
yeah.
You know, I had trouble with anybody taking me seriously right from that age, because even if I tried to join a local band, I was Bionic Reg.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, you're not doing yourself any favours there.
No.
By...
No, I love to self-sabotage, and I always have done. It's just been my favourite thing. And I think it's probably one of the reasons why my brother didn't really want me to be a singer for one of his projects, because I think he recognised that nobody would really take us seriously. Nobody would really believe in what I was doing. And I didn't care, but I think it was more of a concern for the others at that, in the early parts of this band. And you know, I did actually audition for our previous incarnation, because we had a really great singer, but he wasn't able to connect with an audience. Like, he was, I would do the talking and I was playing keyboards and additional guitars. I was really on the periphery of the band. I wasn't actually, you know, in the beating heart of it or anything. I wasn't that involved in the writing. I was kind of, that was when I was at college, and I'd come back to London and hang out with my brother and play with his band. And I was just painting in some sounds, really. But in between songs, it would be me that was talking to the audience, because I didn't mind doing it. And there would be this sort of disjointed voice from the side of the stage. You can hardly even see me, because I was usually behind keyboards and tucked away in the corner.
Mm.
And it was a bit strange. So eventually, I think everybody realized that he wasn't going to be the right front person, and we needed to find somebody else. So he, ironically, ended up being me that had to fire him, which I didn't enjoy at all. He's a lovely bloke, and it was difficult. But he could tell something was wrong, and he challenged me on it.
Oh.
Maybe I was the soft touch or something, but so I just told him. And then we spent 2 years looking for somebody else.
And really?
Yeah, and at the end of that process, I actually auditioned finally. And I remember because all the music had become super inflated and progressive, because we didn't have anybody to guide it, and there was no melody, so it all just became these huge soundscapes. And I tried to sing over one of them. I ended up just screaming over it, as you would probably expect. And I remember my brother leant in at one point and said, "You're in!" Like that. But then I don't think I heard him probably, because I think he actually said, "You're in tune!" Like, I mean, I was just surprised that I was, you know, anywhere near it. And I lost all my confidence, because I just thought, oh, okay, well, I can't even get my own band. I'll just stick to playing guitar and do that instead.
You see, that thing about connecting with an audience, or not being able to connect with an audience, not having that sort of in your wheelhouse, I'm sure it's fine when you're recording an album, because there's nothing, you know, you're doing what you're there to do, is to record the album. But when it's a live show, certainly I've found, you know, you want that as an audience member. You want the interaction. You know, I remember, oh God, it was some years ago now. I remember seeing Oasis at Finsbury Park in London, and it was a big deal, and it was huge, lots of people there. There was zero interaction at all. And I you could feel the audience just sort of feel really deflated and a bit shortchanged, I suppose. You know, we want that. And I'm sure most bands want that. Otherwise, you're just going on just to play your songs and walk off stage. I can't really see how much fun that would be.
Yeah, I mean, there's two ways to do it. I mean, if you have a beautiful voice and the only way you express yourself ever is through song, then I think that's okay. I mean, sometimes it's quite, there's a real mystique to a person that can't do that.
Mm.
But you've got to look a certain way. I think Liam's got the look. You know, but I think if there's somebody who doesn't look like that and they can't make eye contact, I mean, because it can be as simple as eye contact, you know, just finding like a few anchor points in a crowd and just using them as a sort of, I don't know, a go-to set of eyes that you can lock in with when you're addressing the crowd. You can't just look at it as an entity, can you?
Oh my God, that'd be so overwhelming, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think people do feel overwhelmed, but maybe Maybe there's some techniques that can be taught. You know, I think maybe it is just like find a set of eyes, you know, and use them. Because they'll appreciate it. And it is that thing of if you can reach just one person. But I think it's infectious. And if you have any sort of interaction with any member of an audience, immediately you've got the room.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. Yeah. And with size of venues for you as a band, do you sort of, does the show morph or does the theatricality of it change with the different sizes of venues?
I think it does, because I think when you're, the theatricality comes from the heart in the smaller places. And I think you can just use your body to achieve those results. But there's lots of tricks for bigger stages. I think if you're in a small stage, you can wear a black suit and be really imposing. But I think it gets lost if you're playing in a stadium. I think you need, you need to wear a white suit, if anything.
Yeah.
And so there's tricks like that. And I think a lot of the theatricality comes from the production. I mean, if I pay, like, I don't know, 100 quid, it shows how out of touch I am. If I pay any money at all for a ticket, whatever it costs, I'm not really
very
sure.
Good.
It's been a while. But, you know, if I pay for a ticket and I go and see a big show, I want to see a good portion of that being spent on production. I want to see moving light rigs. I want to see pyro, if it's safe to do so. If I see flying, I'm over the moon. Costumes. So, I mean, occasionally a video wall will do it if the content that's up there is well thought out. And like, I love going to see Depeche Mode. I think they're really good at that. You know, in terms of production, it's just awesome. And it's really clever the way they do it. But yeah, but I think if you don't get that and you just get a guy in a stadium, you've got to be a special performer to be able to connect with, what would it be, 100,000 people on
the
stage.
Yeah, and they're few and far between, aren't they?
There are folk like that around.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but as you say, they're a rare breed.
And some sadly no longer with us.
Very true.
So interesting that that girl came up to you and she obviously had a good ear because she said about the operatic quality.
I think she was a violinist.
Right.
Something like that. It's been a while, but we did have a little fascination for one another for a while after that. So her motivation might not have been entirely musical.
Yeah, but I think she was right because it is an extraordinary voice. I don't know what the scale or the levels are on what the... I'm not a singer. But I'm talking about octaves here.
Yeah. I think when you hear a Darkness record, like if you listen to the second album, not many people do, but if you did happen to listen to that, there's a lot of sort of banked up harmonies that we were doing with Roy Thomas Baker, who produced Bohemian Rhapsody. So he knew how to do, you know, to arrange backing vocals in that operatic and sprawling way.
Yeah.
Which is one of the reasons why we wanted to work with him. All those voices are mine. So there's some that are super low, like sound like a Russian male voice choir. And there's some stuff that's probably soprano. I'm not really sure, but there's a few octaves in there. I think I probably, if I stood at a piano, I could probably sing every note within sort of three and a bit octaves. I think it's not that wide. It's not world beating, but I think a lot of singing is just anatomy and you have to play with the hands, you know, the cards that you're dealt.
Yeah.
And anatomy is a really important part of that. There's a singer called I've forgotten his name now. It's gone. But there's a kid in I think he might be from Uzbekistan or something like that, who's got like a 6-octave range.
Jesus.
And it is preposterous. I mean, like when he's singing low, it's hitting you in the chest, and when it's high, it's hurting your ears. It's amazing. And he sings everything in between with loads of different kind of emotional variety and all those parts of his range. I mean, I've heard like some people they register like a super low note, but it's by doing that kind of, they do the sort of heavy metal, not the, you know, the thrash singing, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Which I don't think you can really call singing, because I think there's no expression in it. There's no control of the note. It just happens to be a low note, but it's the same note. It's a monotonous kind of growl. And I think that most people probably have two or three octaves if they practice and they develop it and use it correctly.
When did your confidence, because you said singing wasn't really on the cards, it was all about the guitar. So when did the confidence in your sort of vocal ability begin to grow?
Well, we did 3 shows in 2000. I mean, I was with the stuff when I was, when I was 18 and that little bit of singing there, that was just a bit of fun really. But I think that the confidence really had to sort of kick in when we started doing The Darkness, because it seemed like there's a lot at stake just by being a band that plays in London. You've got the eyes of the industry and all of your friends on you from the first gig. And what happens is, like, you do 3 or 4 gigs and your friends stop coming, you know? So
happen?
No, well, that's what happens in every band, you know? It's like with The Darkness, there was a crossover. Our friends stopped coming, but our fans started coming, and people that just knew us because of our music started coming. It was really like a very quick crossfade, for want of an actual expression. I don't know, you know. So there was that's the worst part, really, because that's when you really need to have balls, because there could be a little lull or a little plateau in your popularity, or, you know, perceived popularity, because when your friends stop coming, you've got to have a fan base.
Yeah.
And you only get about 3 or 4 shows to do that. So I remember I was aware of this because we'd experienced it before with the previous band. And I thought I needed a safety net, really. So if the show's not going well, my plan was to take all of my clothes off and start crying. And I thought, at least, you know, at least they'd remember. Seriously. And so what happened was, like, I wear glasses usually. I started the show in glasses, T-shirt and jeans. I was already really into sort of AC/DC and Bon Scott and all that sort of stuff. And he was my sort of performance idol for the early parts of my singing career. And so it was okay. I mean, I was really shitting myself. And then after about a couple of songs, took the shirt off and was like, oh yeah, here we go. It's better. That's better. Get rid of the glasses, you know, just go for it. And I wasn't in shape. It was just a guy with his shirt off, you know, in a pub. It was brilliant. And after the second show, I found that my tiptoes were on the edge of the stage and I was right in people's faces. Third show, I was in the crowd. And we're always playing at the same place. It was the Monarch in Camden. I'm not sure if you know that place.
Well, I do, because I used to live in Camden.
Right.
For a fair few years. I mean, I lived all around when I lived in London.
What period was that when you lived in Camden?
From what are we in now? So 2005.
Okay, so onwards. it already changed by then, I think, because that's when, around about then, it probably turned into the Barfly.
That's right.
So before it was the Monarch, and we were playing in it while it was still the Monarch. The room upstairs is, I don't know how many people it holds, probably 150 or something.
Mm.
But by the third show, it was packed. You know, we started off opening as well. That's another thing. We started off opening. We were getting higher up the bill just at the Monarch, and it became a sort of residency. We played there a few more times in 2001. And then there was one show when we played in this pub in Balham. And they had sort of like a venue, you know, an events space at the back of this pub. And we did feel like it was, it felt like some of the clientele were perhaps more right wing than us. I don't know. I don't want to say it was like neo-Nazis. I'm not, you know, the Hollywood version would be a neo-Nazi thing, you know, but it wasn't like that. But it just felt a bit hostile. And obviously, I'm camp as Christmas sometimes, you know. And I just picked up my first cat suit from Principal Dancewear in Balham. And that was when the cat suit came out, which is basically a see-through dancing leotard. with a few modifications on it. But I started doing that in 2001. And I was urged by management and band and fans to stop wearing it because you could see everything.
Yeah.
I needed to develop that really. So I stopped again after a while until we could afford a proper one. But you know, it started immediately. The transition into stupidly confident.
But it's like what you've touched on. You said, you know, you've got three or four shows and you've got to hit the ground running. I suppose you've got to make your mark and go, we're here and this is what we do.
Mm.
Come on board.
I remember when we played in America for the first time and we had like, we'd recorded what ended up being the final recordings of I Believe in a Thing Called Love and Love Is Only a Feeling and also Love on the Rocks with No Ice. So we had these brilliant recordings and we couldn't get any interest in the UK, but in America it was different. I think there wasn't like a suspicion that we might be taking the piss out of it. They just sort of seemed to take it at face value. So we had some sort of vague label interest from America immediately. And we were invited to go and play at South by Southwest, which is like the big industry kind of.
Yeah.
It's in Austin and every bar and every restaurant in Austin becomes a music venue and people who are exciting in the music trade throughout the world go there. And we factored in another show, which was at the, I think it was the Roxy. It was supporting a singer-songwriter of some sort. And I remember when we played at the Roxy and we... and I think during the course of the show, I probably ran about 10 miles. I was completely drenched in sweat, wiped out, and we just completely kicked its ass. You know, we gave it everything. And I remember sitting in the dressing room, totally shattered, and I could hear the manager of the main attraction talking to the main attraction and reassuring him that, you know, it's okay, you know, standing still is great. It's iconic. You don't have to worry. We'd really got in his head, you know. So you could feel it. You could feel stuff happening for us, you know, just and people being nervous about us opening for them as well. I mean, it took the only bands that would take us on tour were the ones that really had balls. So the Wild Hearts took us out and that was awesome. And then the next big thing that happened was Def Leppard in 2003.
Really?
Yeah. I mean,
how was that?
Well, you can imagine it. Like somebody came up to me, I think it was at a party or maybe it was after a show or something in at the end of 2002, and nobody knew who we were really. And they said to me, oh, yeah, your band's really exciting. I reckon you're going to get a call from Def Leppard soon. And she worked for must have been like a booking agency or something like that. And I was like, yeah, yeah, whatever, cool, yeah. Brilliant. And but then we did get that call and it was like it was because Joe Elliott is aware of all the music, you know, he has an encyclopedic knowledge of music through time and into the future as well. He really keeps his finger on the pulse with exciting new stuff and he wanted to take us out there and sort of be the guy that took us out. He became like the patron saint of the darkness for a while.
And when you're supporting, because obviously the people that have paid their tickets, they've bought for the headline act.
Mm.
So when you're supporting, do you have to really go out there and give it everything to try and win them over? Or do you just go out there and just do your thing? Does the mindset change?
I think for us and for me, giving it everything is it. You know, there's no other way to do it, really. So
no, there's no half measures, is there?
No, it's got to be like whenever I go out there, I'm treating it like it's my show, and I'm always is it deferential to the main attraction? I'm always saying, oh, I bet you can't wait for this lot. I'm really happy to be here, blah blah blah. But look at this.
Yeah,
you know, see me dance.
But what else can you do? I suppose you can't go out there and. I used to get told off because I'm 6'4"
yeah.
And when I went to drama school, I used to get told off all the time because they said that I was apologizing for my height because I was always sort of, you can't just, you know, you can't go out there.
Because you're intimidating. Did you feel like you're intimidating your other counterparts?
I suppose, I suppose it's a bit like going back to what I was saying about school as well. I didn't want to be a Craig. I wanted to be a Dan. I suppose physically I didn't want to stand out.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to sort of blend in, whereas that's completely wrong because you're an actor. You need to stand out. Mm. But, you know, supporting another band, you can't go out there apologising for being there, can you? You've got to go out there and go, this is what we do.
I had a situation 2 years ago. I think we supported Guns N' Roses at the big stadium in Zurich.
Did they turn up late?
Actually, they didn't that time. I've had a few experiences supporting Guns N' Roses, and there was one. I'll tell you one time we played in where was it? I think it was Mallorca, and it was obviously a big stadium situation, open air. We did our show, came off stage about 9 o'clock, I suppose, and we smashed it. It was awesome. We loved it. It was really great. Great crowd. And the Guns N' Roses crowd usually is great. You know, they're there to have a good time, and they appreciate the openers. And I think they probably appreciated us, especially because he was doing that. He was turning up late and doing stuff like that. So we came off stage, and Frankie, our bass player's brother, was there with his family. So we hung out with them for a bit. Did a few photos and, all right, should we go back to the hotel? Yeah, let's do that. And got to about midnight, we're in the hotel bar, sort of enjoying the moment. And Guns N' Roses still hadn't gone on stage. And we were off site doing the post-mortem in the hotel bar, and they still hadn't gone on stage.
Oh, crikey.
There was, I mean, that was when I think Bumblefoot, the guitar player, was playing with him. He loved us, you know, and I think he went to Axel and said, oh, you got to come see this band. They're fucking awesome. Come check these guys out. And I think that got in his head. I'd like to think it was partly why he was so late. But I don't like sort of mocking him for that, because I do think there's a bit of illness there. I don't think it can be... I don't think you can behave like that and unless there's some other factors in play.
Yeah, of course.
You know, because we played with them more recently on the last one. This is the situation I was about to tell you about, actually. They're on time and brilliant. They played for hours, load of cover versions, loads of costume changes. He had like 5 different coloured cowboy hats and 5 different coloured checkered shirts. It was just everything you'd hope to see, really.
Yeah.
It was brilliant. But when we did our set at Zurich, and I think Swiss crowds are notoriously quiet, and if it isn't exactly what they're paid for, they let you know. By being silent, and it's horrible, you know. It's like pulling even in your own show, it can be difficult. I find it very difficult here. But there was this one guy who's going, rah, 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 and I singled him out in front of, like, I don't know why I did it, in front of 100,000 people. I was like, what the fuck do you think? What do you think Guns N' Roses are going to come out and support themselves? We're here to do a fucking job, and it isn't easy, and it isn't getting any easier because of cunts like you and all this sort of stuff. And as I was doing it, and I can't remember what I said because it was just a tirade, I remember all of his friends just sort of walking away from him. And then he was just sort of standing there on his own being shouted at by an English guy. It was brilliant.
Remember, I'm the one that has the mic.
Yeah, there is a bit of that.
I've got all the power here.
Yeah.
So when, because it for us as an audience, it seemed like the darkness just kind of exploded. But it obviously wasn't just an overnight thing, because it never really is. But how did you deal with being shot to fame like that? Because it seemed like you were everywhere.
I think, you know what, I don't think I did deal with it. That's the reality. It's traumatic because the struggle, which is never people, you know, the innocent bystander is not privy to the struggles that get you to that position, really. The reason why it happened for us is because we worked so hard for such a long time and met such resistance. I think there's a lot of coolness in the UK music trade, and it was sort of the interest that we had from America was really pivotal in our fortunes changing, because we would always get A&R folk, and, you know, some coming to multiple shows and saying, and literally saying to us, I'd love to sign you, but I'm just not allowed. And back in those days, when you actually sold records and had record deals that mattered, and that was actually the goal, getting signed, getting over that line, was the goal, because you couldn't see beyond that. You had no idea what being signed meant. Nobody prepares you for it. And obviously now, looking back, you realize that that's actually when the work starts. But,
right.
But to get to that point, you need to change a lot of people's opinions about what you're doing, especially if you're doing something that's not fashionable. So we had this resistance, and it got to the point where we had Sony, Warners. It was actually East West Warners, but I think I seem to remember that we said, "Well, look, Atlantic in America wants to sign us, and that's a better logo." And I think they actually started the UK, or restarted the UK version of the Atlantic imprint for us. And they went on to sign other things like James Blunt and all that sort of stuff as well. Not everything that they've signed since. It was Ahmet Ertegun's baby, obviously. It's a legendary label that had Led Zeppelin and stuff on it. But the UK version hadn't been active for a long time, and we were the band that made them do that. Because it's basically the same company as East West. It's all the same people.
Right.
But it's called Atlantic, and it has that cachet and, you know, that power. And I love the logo. So... you know, so yeah, I mean, it was only because of the interest in America that we managed to, you know, get anywhere, I think.
Because you kept being met with such resistance, and you had been working your asses off for so long, did it get to a point that you maybe had to have crisis talks and went, we do need to try and fit in the bracket that they want us to be in? Certainly.
Actually, there was a guy called Simon Price. Do you know who that is?
Is he a music journalist?
He is a music journalist.
I do know Simon Price. He has a very distinctive look, if I remember.
Yeah, exactly. You see, you know when he's in a show.
Yes.
And I love him. He's just awesome.
Yeah, he's great.
He said he gave us our first kind of national bit of exposure, and he really seemed to care about the band. What he said was, a lot of people are dismissing this band as the gay AC/DC, but they're not. They're the straight Queen. It's like, wow. It's
wow.
An awesome piece of literature, you know, and it's just like we rode on that for a long time. But he cared so much about the band that at one point he came to us and said, look, this thing's plateaued. You know, you need to do something to get it to the next level because the snowball has stopped. This is when we were doing like the same kind of shows in London. Every show is different, but it's like the level wasn't changing, and people like him were concerned that we wouldn't, you know, kick on, and he really wanted us to. So we just thought, okay, we'll make the album ourselves. We'll do it ourselves, because if we can't get a deal, we'll just do it ourselves. And then so that's when we started doing independent releases. Like the first thing we released was that EP that we had, you know, used to try and get some label interest.
Yeah.
Which had I Believe in a Thing Called Love, Love Is Only Feeling, and Love on the Rocks. We printed 200 copies of it. And it got spot played once on Joe Wiley. And then there were a load of people phoned in saying, what was that? Or how can this band be allowed to exist? Or I love it. You know, these people should be killed or knighted. It really divided the listenership.
But surely that's what we want. That's,
yeah.
As artists, that's what you want. I always say there's nothing worse than someone going, it's fine.
Yeah, but you don't realise that until you experience it.
Yeah.
You know, like you want everybody to like it. But then it's a curious feeling when you realise that people hating it is just as exciting.
Yeah.
It takes a little minute to sink in, and then you realise, oh, wow, I'm doing something right. Because, you know... listen to the charts. It's all shit. It's all shit music. Why would you want to be popular? It's that thing you said earlier, actually.
Yeah.
You know.
But also, you know, you've stuck to your guns. And I think there's such integrity to do that. I think in any, you know, medium, you know, being an artist.
Yeah, I think there's a good way. There's a way of, if you come out of the gates hard and you're a guitar band, there's a way to maintain your success. And I think that is, if you listen to Maroon 5, which was a guitar band, Coldplay, which was a guitar band, and had have maintained that top of the tree stadium selling status, the way you do it is you gradually devolve your status as a guitar band, and you become a singer and a producer. and you can hardly hear the guitars on the more recent records of those bands, but they're always in the charts. They're always called rock bands. It's insane. I mean, it's like they've turned into pop. It's turned into pop music.
Absolutely, 100%.
But I mean, yeah. in the, you know, with a capital P and a small p.
You know? Very much so.
Yeah.
You know. When you said before, you touched on, we were talking about fame, and you said you don't think that you dealt with it well.
So I got sidetracked, Craig. Sorry.
No, it's fine. That's the great thing about these conversations. We just jump around. Were you alluding to sort of your lifestyle at that time?
Not at first. I was going to say that when I got distracted by the struggle of it and sort of how an overnight success is never that.
No.
I think what I was getting at was that I had a lot of bitterness coming into fame because like it was like, finally, motherfuckers. Finally.
Right.
Yeah, we've been doing this for fucking years and now we're famous. It's not us that's changed, it's you that changed. And I was bitter and I was angry. And I think my lifestyle choices were already questionable, Craig. I'm not going to pretend it was the fame that did that.
Okay.
You know, my relationship with, let's talk about drugs, shall we?
Yeah, of course. Let's talk about drugs.
I think just because that's, you know, I mean, that's the most obvious, that's the most obvious consistent mistake that I was making on a daily basis. And I think being famous and having a bit of money makes it easier to pull that off. Mm-hmm. You're sort of in an industry where it's prevalent, so you don't have to look very far to achieve splashdown, and you've got money to spend on it. So I think it's difficult to resist if you're that way inclined, which I was. But I had a my family was affected by heroin in a really acute way, and it was kind of like when I was at college and. Throughout my 20s, I was watching the impact of that on my family, and it was devastating. It was really heartbreaking, and I was super anti everything. I mean, I still drank, but I drank to excess, and then I would stop. But all the time, like any other substances, I was always very, very anti because I'd seen what that particular drug was doing. To friends of mine as well as my family as well. It's like, I think in Lowestoft, it was really, there was for a period of time, it just seemed like everybody was using heroin. Everybody that I knew. And, there was a death. One of my friends, didn't make it. And, so I was looking at all this, stuff and for a few years, I just wouldn't go anywhere near anything that was a class A, or even smoke any grass or anything like that, which I had experimented with as a teenager. But then, part of this character, you know, the guy that I need to tap into to be the guy, I thought. I wasn't convinced that I'd be able to pull it off unless I embraced the whole thing. And I really did find, like, after about 7 or 8 shows, I think we were playing at the Bull and Gate. I had my first experience with cocaine, but not on the show, on the night before the show.
Right.
And unfortunately, the show, on the day afterwards, I completely smashed it. I was a different person, like a different animal altogether, and I didn't recognize myself, but I loved it, and it was awesome. And so then there was a period of time, the next few years, where all of my shows were like that. I honestly think there probably was a period of about 2 or 3 years where I didn't come off stage thinking I'd absolutely smashed it. And that's not because I was doing drugs before or during the show, although that did start to happen when we became super successful.
Right.
I was always kind of waiting until afterwards to do the party, but I was just turning up really fucked, really, really informed by that drug experience. I was skinny. I was weirdly fit and just experimenting with stuff that was expanding my mind and changing my self-perception. And when I was walking on stage, there was nobody else that you would look at in the room. I was completely in control. And
yeah.
It was awesome. You know, I definitely put a lot of that development down to the cocaine. But the problem starts when you do it on show day. that's when it gets really, really unmanageable.
And I'm sure not just for yourself, the problem starts, but I suppose it's for the people surrounding you as well.
I'm not here to throw anybody under any buses, but when I was misbehaving, I wasn't flying solo in those ventures. I was just a little bit worse than everybody else. You know.
Yeah, there's always that one that was going to take it to extremes. Yeah.
And with my family history, I don't know why I didn't recognize that was a possibility. So I think we all needed a bit of guidance, should we say.
When did that, and where did that guidance come along? Did somebody pull you aside and said, were cracks starting to show? Were you worried that it was going to destroy everything that you'd worked so hard?
No, because I stopped seeing it as work and I started seeing it as my existence. So it wasn't like, I didn't value it in the same way that you would if you'd sort of spent generations building up a business like a shoe factory or something like that.
Yeah.
So I didn't have that sort of sense of investment in the things that I'd achieved. I just thought, well, this is what happens when you're me. And when I say me, I mean me, like in inverted commas, you know, like yeah. the guy that I had turned into. So I think there's a bit of truth in that, actually. You know, now as a sober person of 15 years, I still think there's a bit of truth in that. I think that if you believe in what you're doing, you write good songs and you know, I put the work in with my guitar playing as well. I do actually practice and I do actually try and develop as an artist. I don't just show up and behave like a dickhead and expect it all to happen. But that is, that did seem to be the difference between being a band that's at that level and then a band that's at the top level.
Yeah.
It did seem to have I could see a correlation between how bad my behavior was and how successful the band was for a while. Mm. I mean, I do think it sort of backfired when there's a point when it breaks and that correlation doesn't apply anymore. And what you need to do is recognize it. And it takes years to recognize it, I think, because it's the sort of thing that takes hold easily. It's like a bot fly.
Yeah, exactly. And also I'm sure your sense of perception about, is completely thrown out the window.
I think also like the people that you bounce things off, you know, when you change your personality, you can't expect your real friends to stick around. You just can't.
No.
You know, obviously they're always there for you, but when you're not you, you can't expect them to be there.
No, of course not.
So, you know, your whole, I don't know, I suppose it's your focus group. Like we all of us have a focus group, don't we? Whether it's your cat, you know, your cat will tell you which kind of food it likes and it, you know what I mean? And
absolutely. Yeah.
and if you're,
we all need the focus group.
Even you if do. Yeah.
It takes time to realize that we do need it. Mm. We really do.
Yeah. But when your focus group changes to people that like you, when you're behaving like that, you're in a lot of trouble, you know, you're in serious trouble. And I remember the first person that took me to one side, might surprise you, it was James Hetfield from the Metallica.
Really?
Yeah. Because we were on tour with them in Australia on a big day out tour, and he could see it. And he was like, give me his number and numbers of people that I could talk to and whenever I was sober on that tour, we were talking and I don't know, because I think it's like a certain part of a certain type of recovery. It helps you to try and help other people, I think, doesn't it? It's part of the experience of it. I mean, I've never done the 12 steps thing. I had a different approach, but I think that was part of his recovery as opposed to mine, but it was definitely a person that recognized it and took me to one side. Meanwhile, somebody else in his band who shall remain nameless, but I will just say this, it rhymes with SARS.
Go on, you can spit it out.
SARS goal brick.
Very good.
Meanwhile, I was misbehaving with him, and he was pulling me in the other direction. I was already I knew by about 2004 that there was something I needed to address, and I tried to do a few different things. The label actually recommended a guy who would show up on his moped and then talk to me about my problems.
How did that work out?
It was a little bit like trying to lasso a herd of stampeding cattle. You know,
right?
I don't think it touched the sides really, and it cost me a lot of money. I had to pay for his moped journeys as well as the actual kind of therapy
sessions. Yeah.
Yeah. And I wasn't ready to listen to it really. So,
well, that's the thing, isn't it? That's what I was going to touch on. You know, you can be getting pulled aside by certain members of other groups and said, look, you know, I can see what you're going through because I've been through it and you need to do this. But you have to be ready within yourself to even begin to start talks about getting sober at that point. And obviously, you just weren't ready. Mm. So what was the point when you believed that you should get sober, so you listened to yourself?
I can't, Craig, talk about that moment yet. I'm not ready for it.
Okay.
It was something happened, and I have to... I can't really.
Justin, that's absolutely fine, man.
But you know, I think that's. But just to you know, what I can say is, it's the same with anybody. I think it's not. You can be aware that there's something that needs to change, but something will actually come and change it.
Yeah.
And something will happen that will haunt you. I mean, it does. But what happened haunts me now.
And mate, so I don't want to carry on down this road. I want you to feel as comfortable as possible.
Okay, but
we're having such a lovely conversation.
Yeah,
so.
No, thanks, mate.
But do you know what, man? That's 15 years sober. So, and I have to say, and people listen to this, and I'm not just blowing smoke here, you look fantastic. You do look rare. I'm very jealous.
I did have a shower and a shave.
The same age.
Yeah, no, you look great too. Don't worry about it. But I think, you know, I know. I don't want to leave a gaping hole in your broadcast, so I'm just
going to
say this.
You're not going to. This is the very nature of these conversations, and that's why I started this all these years ago. And we have such varied talks with all sorts of people in the creative industry, and I love it so much. So this is just another brilliant conversation. You don't need to worry about nothing.
Okay. Well, it's helping me to talk about it to a degree, although I did nearly cry. So maybe I needed to, but you know, I think the problem with it is, like, when you have that moment when something changes your attitude and makes you realize you've got to change your behavior, it's the same thing as getting signed as a band. That's actually when the work starts. And as I said before, I didn't do the 12-step thing. I don't go to meetings. I don't do anything like that. I just hold on to what happened.
You know? Sure.
And but because I think that's a traumatic event, but there's a lot of other stuff that happens when you're famous and when you're, like, as you said before, like suddenly shot to stardom or you know, everyone knows who you are suddenly. I do think that there's something about that that's really traumatic and takes a lot of adjusting. So even at the point when you stop, your brain doesn't go back to being normal. I think that there's probably chemical stuff that needs to realign. There's, I think there's psychological elements of it. I mean, when I stopped drinking and doing all that stuff, I actually took myself out of the band, which was a big mistake. Kind of. What I should have done is had it as a genuine hiatus and actually said, look, I need this period of time to work on myself. But I didn't. I actually just put it all away, and I think I did that as a sort of as an exercise, really, to sort of say, "Look, these are the things that are going to trigger me. This is the person. This is the project that's made me into what I am. And I got to deconstruct everything, and I can't do it." So
if you're still in it.
Yeah, if I'm still in it, I didn't think I would be able to pull it off. There's no way of knowing whether that was accurate or not, really, but that was the decision I made at the time. And I do think 15 years sober is a, you know, it does show you that there might have been some wisdom in the choices that I made at that moment, because I do think I would be dead. That's something that I'm pretty sure I would have been dead by now. So, you know, I felt like at the time it had to happen, but it was really damaging to my relationship with my brother. Less importantly, the rest of the band, and everything gets mended and people forget, and time is a great healer.
Absolutely.
And we're back working but for the first sort of two or three albums, my main motivation for working was to make it up to my brother and to a lesser extent, the other guys. It's only now, like the last couple of albums, I think, where I've got other things in my life that I need to worry about, where I'm, you know, writing from the point of view of somebody who actually has something to say, you know. So I think the journey, that 10 years, you can't really call it 10 years or 15 years sober. I think the first 10 years of it is a period of adjustment to sober life and,
right,
you know, putting a reset on the character that I'd created and trying to find a different character. It's one long identity crisis, as I don't know.
Which we know, going right back to the change of personalities at school, right?
Yeah, I mean, I never thought of it like that, but actually moving around at school is probably the one has been a real, really helped me to prepare for this lifestyle, you know.
But you do strike me as an artist. It's funny you say that about taking yourself out of the band, you know, that situation at that time. But you always strike me as somebody that needs to create, whether it's on the guitar or you need to write. Is there still that need with your artistry?
Yeah. I mean, there always was as well. Like, I couldn't stay away from it for long. I just couldn't do it with the darkness, really.
Yeah.
So I started doing other stuff, you know, I had another band and everything, but really that was keeping my hand in. I wanted to work with some extraordinary musicians and see what gigging with people like that was. And what I noticed was that whilst I love those people and they're amazing players, like to the level of, I would say, they've got to be on the spectrum for them to be as good as they were. You know, there's something like an autism or an Asperger's thing that makes them as good as they are. Because I've never experienced musicianship like that before. But it didn't have the magic. And I don't think that's something that you can really stay away from. And I don't know whether it's the magic because my brother was in the band, or the magic because of the songs, or something about the alchemy of the four people that are involved, you know.
Well, that's it, isn't it? It's all the elements that come together. It's a bit like, you know, we were talking about singing before, you know, you're talking that guy that's got like six octaves, whatever. Yeah, I'm sure lots of, they tried to teach me singing at drama school and failed miserably. I think, you know, some people say you can teach singing, but with things like that, it's just a gift. It's just there. And it's a bit like the magic. It's the elements have all been put there and it's right time, right place. And that's and if you take one element away,
yeah,
it ain't there, is it?
I think that's true. And I think, when we first started it off, it was kind of like you could feel that it was special. But you can't, I mean, I've been in bands with my brother before. It wasn't because of that. Been in bands with Frankie before. It wasn't because of that. There was just something about it. And, you know, you can feel it. And people could feel it. But, you know, right place, right time. We were right place, wrong time, I think. We would have done much better in the 70s and 80s. Because I think that we would have had less sort of resistance to it as a genre. You know, rock music with guitar solos was certainly not in the charts in the noughties. But I think it was in the 80s and the 70s.
Absolutely, yeah. You know,
I think the 90s was a bit of a great reset for guitar music, really. And I love some of it, so I'm not even knocking it, really. But it's just part of the you know, evolution of it, really. But so I think right place, wrong time, but we made it the right time because we kept on going. You know, so when the right time came and the zeitgeist was there to be captured, we had the net and we were ready for it.
Yeah.
We were ready for it musically, but we weren't ready for it as personalities. You know, it's like that. Basically, it was like Robert Shaw. It was Quint. We had the equipment that you need to land the shark, except for the boat itself, which wasn't big enough.
Oh, Justin, this has been everything and more. What a lovely, lovely conversation. Thanks so much, man, for coming on. I've really enjoyed it.
My pleasure. I've loved it too, actually. It's been quite brilliant. Cathartic, actually.
That's what I aim for. Yeah. Well, look, all the best with everything moving into the tour, and lots of love. I'm going to go and have another cup of tea, and I suggest you do that too.
Enjoy it.
Take care, my friend.
Nice one, Craig. Thanks.
And another episode is done. What did I tell you? How great is he? So lovely. And obviously you heard that we got into some sort of avenues that you know, Justin didn't want to go down, and I certainly didn't want to push or explore that anymore, because, as well, you know, I want everybody to feel that they can talk about, you know, what they want to, and they can shut things down. He certainly didn't shut it down. I feel he was trying to explain why he didn't feel ready to talk about things like that. And that is to be respected. I hope I was respectful in that way. I hope that came across, because I truly was. I would never, ever want a guest to feel uncomfortable at all. But we ended the call, we ended the recording, and then we carried on talking for another 15 minutes. He's great, great company, and I'm really thrilled that he came on. I should have said there's quite a bit of swearing as well, shouldn't I? Oh, well, you know, you're used to that by now. And sorry, Mum, if you're listening to this. So, you know where we are. We're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. You can email us to shotpod@gmail.com. See, I know the emails. No flies on me. Drop us a message on Twitter. Come say hello on Instagram. Do all the things that you need to do to get involved, really. That'd be nice, wouldn't it? Shall we get together next week and do it all again with somebody else? Yeah, I think we should. Well, until next Thursday, I've been Craig Parkinson. He's been producer Griff. And this has been the Two Shot Podcast. You take care. I'll see you next week. The Two Shot Podcast is presented by me, Craig Parkinson, recorded and produced by Thomas Griffin for Splicing Block. Our music, our brilliant music, is courtesy of Then Thickens. Cheers.